I'm gonna leave it with this one. It's all about next week, same place, same time, and I see it. It's all about positive and CKUT and the Banshee FM. On the behalf of myself, John Black Nadine. Whatever you do this weekend.
This National Greening Program is planting seedlings across 5 regions of the country: BC, the Prairies, Ontario, Quebec, and the Atlantic. They plant in areas that are in need of reforestation or afforestation across Canada. Tree Canada selects sites where appropriate native species will be planted to make sure that natural forests come back to life. To learn more or to get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news and brought to you live.
Good afternoon, welcome to Labor Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM here in Montreal. This is our February edition, airing every third Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. I am your co-host Stéphane Doucette, always joined with
Mustafa Hanawi, and really excited to be with you for this February edition of Labor Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. www.ckut.ca on the web. And this month we've got our special interview with writer, journalist, intellectual Vijay Prashad, and we'll talk more about that when we get to the interview. But we also wanted to talk about a few key local issues that are one is dominating, obviously, international and local headlines, which is the Freedom Convoy, in quotes, as well as the deal struck between Uber and UFCW, United Food and Commercial Workers Union, because as major implications, I think it's something we're going to talk about more. I mean, now, but also in our upcoming episodes.
It was announced a few weeks ago now that the UFCW had struck a deal with Uber. And this is a company that has been sort of in the crosshairs of labor for a long time, ever since they started, really. And as well as in the crosshairs of taxi companies and taxi drivers. What UFC did was make a behind closed doors deal to offer some services to Uber drivers. Now, this is not the typical way that a union operates when they organize a workplace, and that's because this is not a typical deal. This is not a contract signed between the workers and Uber with union representation, but something completely different and something basically unprecedented. Like Mustafa just mentioned, we're going to dig more into this in the future because I think it has really big significance for the economy as it is, that is being sort of Uberized, as some people say, but also just for labor generally as a movement, for inter-union relationships, because the Canadian Union of Postal Workers was involved with trying to organize rideshare app workers. Anyways, there's a lot to discuss there. I don't know if you want to add to that, Mustafa, or...
I mean, in terms of... I think for the Uber and the UFCW question, I mean, it really is going to raise, because it just doesn't affect, you know, Uber. It affects Uber Eats. It affects all of Uber's operations. And obviously this something comes off of the heels of Uber losing in Europe badly and getting bloodied in a way. You know, in Spain, there was the court decision to actually making platform companies actually release not only classifying drivers as workers, but then also making unions, or making the data available in terms of their algorithms or programs that actually manage the workforce. So what drivers get what shift, what location they can, restaurants they pick up in, all those decisions that are just considered algorithmic or that pop up on a driver's screen now have to be given to drivers. So then drivers know, will have a leg up. And I think that was a huge defeat for these big gig companies. And also in London, there was the legal victory, you know, recently of the Uber drivers being classified as workers. I mean, in it was quashed in California with the referendum. But obviously now there's this, I think, fear that, like, Uber, on behalf of all these big companies, are like, we're going to be responsible as employers. And if we don't want to be responsible as employers, we got to find a way out of this, right? And I think this UFCW deal is really dangerous because it protects them, right? And then, like, even though it's unclear what the legal fallout will be, because, you know, you were talking about they're not paying dues, there is no collective agreement. So what does that mean in terms of the classification of workers? But I guess that will be decided provincially. Will UFCW be recognized? Is it going to act as a shield? So, I mean, I think a lot of these things are really unclear, but I think it's a sad day for the labor movement, especially when they didn't need to do this, right? Like, you had amazing, you know, when we talked with Gig Workers United, right? Like, there's been solid organizing on the ground. So why aren't unions just supporting that organizing, right? Where people are making demands, are winning reclassification, are winning health and safety, but instead it's like the fifth column to... So it's, I think it's like a really dangerous precedent, and like, and these initiatives, you know, rarely worked. It didn't work with, you know, steel and the taxi drivers or with domestic workers. I mean, it's clear we need to unionize you know, Uber and platform workers and delivery drivers. But one that really is like based on their demands and what they want, and then also in terms of them actually having, yeah, having an actual vote on the union, right? And this is yeah, it makes UFCW, I mean, it will just make workers hate the union even more because they didn't select the union.
So we'll talk more about that probably next month, I'm assuming. We'll see who we can grab to talk about this. It's obviously something that we could talk about for an hour, but yeah, we got other stuff on our plate. Before we get to VJ, though, just a few words on the so-called Freedom Convoy. There's obviously been some unions that have put out statements against it, as well as the Canadian Labor Congress. Others have pointed out to the relative, like, slowness of labor to react to this. It is being sort of claimed as, like, a pro-worker movement by some people. Others, like, have written about what we can learn from the truckers. I think that what we can learn from the truckers is that the far right is getting organized, and what we know about the far right getting organized is that unions and labor generally have to be in a big alliance to fight it. And that's about it, as far as I'm concerned. And all this stuff about it being truckers, I mean, it's been fairly well documented by a number of news outlets, whether it's Press Progress, even the CBC did some half-decent journalism on this. It doesn't excuse their terrible coverage, but there's some there. Rank and File has done some. Passage also have talked about sort of the roots of this movement, and it's very far from labor in more than just their demands, but also their composition.
No, and I mean, one of the things that's striking, like from our own experience at the center, is that most truckers, there was a great, I mean, Ethan Cox actually from Ricochet, you know, pointed out there's 300,000 truckers in Canada, and they counted, like the RCMP, and there was like 113 trucks in the initial convoy that drove through, right? So this idea, this like huge mass movement, is like of working class truckers or truck drivers is a bit off. Also, a lot of them are just like owner operators, right? Like half of the truckers in this country are South Asian, and that doesn't include the other immigrants that are also, you know, there's lots of people who come as temporary foreign workers from the Philippines and Jamaica who come as truck drivers, right? So it's clear it's this tiny minority of truck drivers. That doesn't mean that, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean, and also that they're owner operators, right? And so this is also a different kind of what segment of the working class they are, and what holds their views. And yeah, it's clear this is about not even those mandates. I mean, what's scary is that the tactics show this kind of fear more of the shift to the right, right? Like, you know, they've held this convoy, and then all of a sudden now their key demands are beginning to get won, right? So we're going to be in a context where they're emboldened, not weakened, right? Like, mandates all of a sudden are getting dropped everywhere. Even if they wanted to before, this is now like the context, right? And so, like, all of these mainstream right-wing parties, like the Conservatives or CAC, are afraid electorally they're going to capitulate to them, right? So that's clear, that's their base. Not a working-class base, not, you know, so I think it politically we're going to be in, like, you know, to me it's like a watershed of, like, a more dangerous moment. Not because it's they're a mass movement, but they're organized enough that they're shifting things, you know? Like, they're shifting the discourse.
I think, yeah, and we just need to pay attention to what are the demands of capital right now and how well they align with what the truckers' movement supposedly is asking for. One of the most interesting things that I noticed that passage again pointed out was the incidence of the key words essential workers tended to spike with every wave of the new variants. This time it did not. And what that to me demonstrated was that capital was no longer willing to pay for workers to have hazard pay or to stay safe at home, and what they wanted was to just open the floodgates, and that's exactly what this movement has asked for. I don't think it's a coincidence. I think that coincidences that big are a farce, you know? So anyways, we could obviously talk more about that because it's on everyone's lips, but Mustafa, do you want to introduce our interview for this episode?
So, on this episode, our key interview is with Vijay Prashad, who many of our listeners probably will know, have read one of his numerous books or his articles in all kinds of different magazines and outlets. And we spoke with Vijay Prashad about specifically labor in the Global South. So we spoke to him really thinking about the question of labor in a more global sense, the ways that the global capitalism is organized and how capital is organized and what does that mean for the working class in the Global South. And the reason we did so because Vijay Prashad is someone who's always written from that perspective, right, of the Global South, right? He's Vijay Prashad is an Indian historian, journalist, commentator, and as well as a Marxist intellectual. He's the executive director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. He's also the chief editor of Leftward Books in India. And he's been the author of 30 books, including The Arab Spring, Libyan Winter, The Karma of Brown Folks, one of his more popular books, The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, won the Asian American Writers Workshop for Best Nonfiction, also The Poorer Nations, Possible History of the Global South, and most recent works, Washington Bullets, with a preface by Evo Morales. He's also chief correspondent for The Globetrotter, a project of the Independent Media Institute, columnist for Frontline, as well as different outlets in India. He's also been an active supporter of the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement as an advisory member of the U.S. campaign for academic and cultural boycott of Israel. So it's clear we have someone that's really, you know, a special guest to have to talk about the current juncture we're at and what does that mean for labor more generally and what's the role in terms of labor challenging global capital at this moment and more broadly imperialism. So I don't know if you have anything else to add about the Vijay interview.
Well, just that it was thrilling to interview him. He's someone that I've read a lot of his books and a lot of his non-book work over the years. So I'm sure that you'll find this interview really fascinating. So thanks again for listening. You're tuned to 90.3 FM CKUT here in Montreal and all over the world at ckut.ca.
vision. O shele. Mi gbo dada. Mi ti gbo. Eshi.
So welcome to Labor Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM. And on this month's edition, we are very much honored to have an incredible special guest that, you know, that really has informed, I think, a lot of people's political thought. He's been, a really groundbreaking journalist, public intellectual, writer. So it's a real honor to have Vijay Prashad here on Labor Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. And just to let people know that you can always catch us on the web, www.ckut.ca, or on our Facebook on Labor Radio. So thank you very much, Vijay, for coming on today's show on Labor Radio.
Super excited to be with you. The name itself is great, by the way, Labor Radio. There's no euphemism there. It's the radio of the working class, guys. The radio of the working class.
We try to be the radio of the working class. And the reason why we actually wanted to have you specifically on the show is very much, you know, we're here in the belly of the beast. And, you know, a lot of our perspectives around class, around labor, you know, is very much inward focused. And, you know, you as director of the Tricontinental Institute, you know, your works such as, you know, The Poor Nations, A Possible History of the Global South, is really to begin to think about the question of labor and the question of class in a more global perspective. And what's taking place in the world, and what's shaping labor struggles in the global South today. And so one of the first questions really wanted to ask you is, you have a much more dynamic take
on the question of imperialism, really what, in terms of global capitalism, in terms of what's shaping the conditions for the overwhelming majority of the world today, and what are the issues that imperialists face outside of sort of the normal realms of thinking about questions of imperialism and of global capitalism. So, I mean, really to ask you, firstly, to kind of contextualize, what is shaping labor in the global South today?
Yeah, it's great to talk to you about these things. These are fundamental issues. Let me make three observations, and I'm being clear, these are observations. I don't, you know, presume to have a big theory. The first one is quite obvious, which is that, you know, we're talking about hundreds of countries, you know, billions of people. There are enormous disparities, and there's enormous sectoral disparities as well. You know, a bus driver in Cairo has a very different kind of place in society than a bus driver, say, in Santiago, Chile. These bus drivers both drive buses, but in one place they may be in a union. You know, they may have salaries that don't keep them at the edge of deprivation and so on. So the first observation, obvious one, is that there's enormous disparities. We shouldn't forget that. The second thing is the structure of labor in large parts of what's known as the global South. You know, let's be clear about this. There is a racial and colonial angle to this. During the era of colonialism and then after colonialism, a kind of racist attitude developed that people in certain parts of the world, let's say in parts of Asia, particularly the southern belt of Asia, in very large parts of the African continent, in parts of Latin America and certainly in the Caribbean, there was an understanding that came out of the colonial era that these people don't actually need that many resources. Their understanding of life aspirations is limited. You know, in fact, when a Union Carbide factory exploded in Bhopal in 1984, the head of American Sinamid, which is a big chemical, sounds like a bloody, you know, cyanide or something. It's a big chemical company. The head of that company said, well, in India, they have a different understanding of life. You know, when 1,000 people die, well, they don't miss them because they get reborn. In the West, every life is sacred and so on. I mean, this is a company executive saying that not in, you know, 1884 or in 1784, but in 1984, which might as well be this year. So there's this attitude from colonialism, a racial attitude that people in these parts of the world just don't need that much to live on, you know, a little bit of food, small apartment. They don't really need to go to college. You know, they don't aspire to these things. So this racist attitude allows for wages to be systematically suppressed in these parts of the world. In fact, Marx mentions this in Capital. He occasionally alludes to the fact that not only is surplus value or wealth taken from the workers through increasing the working day or through adding productivity, but also just plain theft from people who are in the colonies. You know, he alludes to that. Well, that colonial suppression of wages continues to the present day. Wage levels in parts of the world outside the core countries of the West and Japan and other places are extremely low. They are underneath any natural wage that should be there in their societies. So people who work a full day in India, for instance, a construction worker barely has enough money to eat for the day, to maybe feed their children, maybe find a place to live, and certainly not have enough to educate their children or to have leisure, you know, to develop themselves in a kind of cultural way, to go see a movie, you know, listen to the radio, have a radio and so on. Indexes of deprivation in places like India, extreme. You know, the government does studies, how many people have refrigerators, how many people have a fan, and the numbers are extraordinary. You know, majority of people don't have a way to move. In other words, from a bicycle to a jet plane, they don't own a way to convey themselves. They don't have a way to preserve food. They don't have a way to cook food. Majorities of people. That's why 2.7 billion people in the planet are on the edge of starvation because their wages have been depressed. Well, you see, that's the second observation, and I want people to take it seriously, that there are parts of the world where wages are artificially suppressed, not by the market. This is by old colonial relations. The third observation related to this is any time in this zone, a political project arises, you know, with a political leader. That's how projects manifest themselves. Thomas Sankara will arrive in Burkina Faso in 1983. Anytime a political project comes up and says, listen, we want to change this situation. We want to get out of wage suppression. We want sovereignty. Then they are targeted by information war, by wars, by assassinations, by coups, and so on. So the what we see of imperialism, you know, the wars, the coup d'etats, the information war, and so on, that's the tip of the iceberg. Beneath that tip is this systematic wage suppression and systematic suppression of the ability of these states to claim a larger royalty for the sale of their raw materials and so on. So copper-producing countries like Zambia have their own share of the royalty suppressed. Zambian workers have their wages suppressed. Wage suppression and royalty suppression is at the heart of imperialism. Imperialism isn't just an attitude that says, let's go bomb a country. Why are you bombing the country? Because they no longer want their royalties and wages to be suppressed. That cannot be permitted to become a political act. Chavez has to be overthrown, says Peter Monk of Canada, head of Barrick Gold. He says that in the Canadian press. Chavez has to be overthrown. Why? Because Chavez is not allowing Canadian mining companies, 60% of world mining companies domiciled in Canada. Chavez was not allowing Canadian mining companies to take the maximum royalty home. He said, no, you got to invest it in Venezuela. That was why there is this hatred of Venezuela, frankly.
No, and on that question of wage suppression and that's at the heart of imperialism, you know, recently there was a report by the Tricontinental Institute, sort of, putting back into the lens these sort of global supply chains or these global value chains as part of these imperialist projects. So there was a recent report on the iPhone and kind of the value chain of the iPhone, and if you can talk about what that has meant in sort of in kind of, you know, what people term as globalization, because it's something you've written about quite extensively.
You see, I have no problem with globalization or internationalism, which is the better way to see it. But even globalization, I mean, I'm okay with it. Like, we need to integrate with each other. You know, we need to integrate at a deep level, culturally, socially, economically, politically, you know, global solidarity, all of that. We are not people who want to parochialize, you know, each other. Imagine you live in Canada. Imagine what your shopping will be like, your food you'll be eating if you are not in an integrated setup. Okay, I know the carbon footprint is enormous. You should eat, but you'll get scurvy living in Canada during the winter. You need to import greens and so on, you know. So I don't have a problem with globalization in general, in the abstraction. I want to say that because most of us are then portrayed as kind of, you know, let's go back to closed nation states and so on. That's not what we're talking about. The problem is the advantages of globalization, just as the advantages of productivity, are all seized by a tiny minority of people. That's the problem. You see, what are we talking about? A lot of big companies like Nike or Apple. Apple doesn't make computers. You know, the computer is made by subcontractors like Foxconn and so on. Apple iPhone is not made by Apple. Apple designs the phone and then Apple brands the phone. It, in fact, doesn't even sell it. Amazon, more than Apple, gets the phone to you. You know, most people aren't going to the Apple store to buy. You know, if you live in most of the world, there are no Apple stores, guys. You're buying it from Amazon or from other platform capitalist commercial outlets. So Apple itself doesn't make the phone. Foxconn makes the phone and a whole bunch of other subsidiary companies. The phone is then carried by ships, most likely some Greek ship carries it to the port of Los Angeles. It goes to an Amazon warehouse. Somebody gets on the computer. They don't go to the Apple website. They go to the Amazon website and they buy the phone, it gets delivered to them by either Amazon or a subcontractor, you know, who comes in their own car where they put a little sticker saying Amazon. In parts of the world, you don't have Amazon trucks anyway, or by other mail services that deliver it. I don't know if Canada still has a Royal Mail or whatever they call it now, Prince Andrew Mail. There was a time in the 80s when Canada seriously thought of making Prince Andrew the King of Canada. You know, I remember that very well. That would be a serious scandal now, wouldn't that? How exciting for Canada. Yes, something to discuss in the winter months, long winter months. So, you know, the issue here isn't like, oh my God, you know, globalization, it's bad. It's that what Apple is able to do is because of the strength of intellectual property laws that advantage a company like Apple. Apple has other people produce the phone, often in countries where there's extreme wage suppression. They get raw materials from countries where there's extreme royalty suppression, like the Congo and other countries, Democratic Republic of Congo. There's royalty suppression, there's wage suppression. And then Apple, because it has an intellectual property patent on its phone, sells it for a very high price, you know, quite a high price. And so the rate of return for Apple on basically zero investment, what is Apple investing in? It's not investing in either mining or in production. Apple invests in design, both the design, technological design, the software, the hardware, and then the design of the packaging, the brand design. That's what Apple invests in. It's not investing in production, actually. That's Foxconn, which is in China, a Taiwan-based company. They invest in production, you know, they build the factories, they hire the labor, all of that stuff. So what happens is that these platform companies or these intellectual property companies, like Apple is essentially a rent collector. It collects rent off its product that it sells. These rent collecting firm, platform firms, these intellectual property firms, they just take all the benefits of globalization, you know, and workers in the commodity chain just can't organize. I mean, I've seen this in many countries because what happens? It's what we in Tricon call disarticulated production. You know, you take a phone, you know, the screen, the glass screen on the phone, you have 50 companies around the world make those screens, source the screens, okay? None of the companies have either a high investment quotient. The person who starts the company doesn't have to invest that much because they're not making the whole phone, they're just making the screen. So you can be a small capitalist, you know, with a small shed making these screens. So that means the investment isn't high. So you can have 50 of these, 60, 100 of them supplying their suppliers. That's a glorified word for a tiny capitalist with a shed who's sending these glass pieces to the next stage of the commodity chain. The workers, they cannot organize, because if the workers organize in that little shed and go on strike, Apple's commodity chain will stop buying from that factory. They just cut them out. So actually, this supply chain model, it's very efficient for production, but it means workers lose the possibility of trade union struggle, the capacity to fight, and progressive governments can't nationalize companies because you'll end up nationalizing like a shed which produces the glass. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, if you cannot have a trade union or you cannot nationalize, the two great instruments of building worker power in the 20th century are gone. And that's one of the reasons why working class power globally has suffered, you know, globally. Canadian workers will have a hard time organizing because they also struggle with the debilities put in place in the system by the commodity chain.
Well, yeah. And so maybe we have time for one or two more questions, but I wanted to ask you about that, specifically the relationship that you just outlined between the inability of workers in what you describe as the sheds and in Canada, the difficulty that they're both facing as a result of this type of production. I mean, there has been, and I mean, I'm part of groups that try to think of what does international labor solidarity look like. You know, there's very small initiatives in certain ways. There's the World Federation of Trade Unions that's much bigger, but also is like not in Canada, for example. I'm wondering what you see as the future of global labor solidarity, like what kind of organizational framework can there be? Any insights into that?
Well, let me give you a couple of, again, observations. One straightforward thing is the experience of India. In India, 90%+ of the working class is in the informal sector, outside unions. You know, union density is like 4% or something, very low. And yet, in November 25th or 26th, 2020, 250 million Indian workers went on strike. How? Because the organized trade union sector took up the issues of the unorganized workers. And they built a strike wave over the course of a decade where organized working class trade unions, big unions, even 4 or 5% in India, it's big, man. Multiply 4% by hundreds of millions, a lot of people. But still small. Because they took up the cause of, say, Anganwadi workers. These are creche workers, workers who work with children, government workers who take care of children, preschool children. They took up the cause of Anganwadi workers. They took up the cause of ASHA workers. These are the public health workers, you know, who are treated abysmally by the government. They took up the issues. They took up their demands. You know, they spoke for them, brought them out onto the street, my friends. That's one. And linked to that was the farmer struggle. The Indian government tried to Uberize farming in India, you know, make the kind of structure of an Uber driver where you are reliant on an app and you don't know who the other drivers are and so on, totally alienated from the possibility of solidarity. They tried to Uberize farming and the farmers went on, tens to hundreds of millions of farmers went on strike for a year and defeated the government. So the first thing I just want to say is it's really important in our struggles for unions to recognize that we can't play sectoral politics anymore. You gotta speak in the name of the entire working class. You know, it's not enough to think of your local or your shop or even your union. You gotta think of the working class in general. And that is a habit that I'm afraid many unions have forgotten, to think of themselves as rooted in the working class, not in their sector or their shop and so on. So that's number one. And I think the Indian example really shows you the gains that can be made if that attitude shifts. The second thing I want to say is it's really, really extraordinarily important to keep plugging on the idea of worker solidarity with other workers and to start campaigns against the big corporations who are often domiciled in the north. As I said, Canada is home to 60% of the world mining companies. You know, I was recently on the phone with mining leaders in Papua New Guinea, where there is a big Canadian company. Recently, a man was killed while at work because of negligence of the company. And when he died, he said some very moving things, and I'm going to be writing about it. But I was talking to MacDean at the site. His brother himself was killed by the equivalent of Pinkertons, you know, for a Canadian mining company. Where is the Canadian population? Why are they not rising up against this mining sector? Why are people not making noise? I know there's like, you know, there are watchdog groups in Canada doing really important work, writing reports and so on. I'm not talking about them, you know. Where are the anti-globalization type people now after all those years of being in Montreal at that big protest and so on? Why are they not going and protesting in front of the mining companies? Why do Canadians tolerate that the University of Toronto's School of International Politics is named after the Monk family, the family of Barrick Gold? There should be an all Canada-wide campaign to remove Monk's name from that school. It's an insult to international studies in Canada. In fact, it suggests that Canadian international studies departments, if they are willing to take the name Monk above them, are in collusion with the mining company. So solidarity is super important, Stefan. Should not be, you know, set down as a secondary, tertiary thing. Raise the temperature at home on these issues, please, friends. And the third thing, which is important, is, you know, we know that despite the fact that nationalization and unionization is hard on the commodity chain, there are two amazingly big vulnerabilities. One is transport workers. That includes dock workers. And the other is workers who manage databases. See, we haven't seen a proper strike of Amazon database operators. Imagine they go on strike. You know, they say we are going to close the database down. Amazon will be shut down for a day. For one day, Amazon database workers go on strike. I can't wait for that. That's a huge vulnerability. You know, somebody has to organize database operators. And then linked to that is transportation. You know, truck drivers, port workers. You know, if the ports of Canada are closed for a day, you know, imagine what that would, the signal that would send, immense solidarity. If tomorrow the ports in Canada close in solidarity with the Canadian people, you know, because the COVID-19 thing is not, whatever, some issue, that sends a signal that the global commodity chain is weak, you know, is weak. So these are three observations I've made, you know, but I really, really hope that people in Canada take seriously this really murky history of Canada, the mining companies, the native people of Canada, where this is also an issue regarding mining companies and land and so on. I hope it becomes a real issue, not just sectoral issue for, you know, Mining Watch and other groups that do very important work. This should be the responsibility of all Canadian citizens, not just the NGOs.
Maybe one last question and from me is, what do you see, Vijay, as coming up as sort of the fault lines, you know, for our struggles in the near future? And if there is a small moment, and what are that? Because you talked about the struggles in India of the peasants, of the farmers, of the mass general strike. Where else do we see similar struggles sort of brewing in the global south that deserve our solidarity and attention and may not be?
You know, struggles, history is a very unkind process because they never come the way you want them to come. You know, let's be frank. I mean, one of the geniuses of Frantz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth was, Fanon says the world is structured violently. You know, the colonial world is a violent world. And he says that how can you not expect the people who have been suffering oppression and exploitation not to act with anger, you know, and then be violent themselves and so on. Sometimes protests appear in all kinds of ways, the burning down of buildings, you know, real just anger on the street, frustration, looting, you know, the frustrations come out in these ways. Also, coup d'etats, you know, I mean, we've been hearing about so many coups on the African continent recently. It's not a surprise. People are frustrated, angry. There's no outlet. There's no proper grammar of political outlet, you know. Reasonable way to be political is the following. Please don't lecture me, okay? You've created a violent world and therefore people will act violently against that world. Why does it surprise you? That was the lesson of Frantz Fanon, Wretched of the Earth, 1961. Brilliant, you know, brilliant, brilliant book, because that book came before all the anti-IMF riots, you know, that came after that book, one riot after the other. The great bread riot in Egypt in 1971, you know, I think it was 71. People just took to the streets and said, we will not play one, you know, 1 pound more for our weekly bread, you know, whatever, we refuse. Bread riot, Egypt, 2011. What was the Tahrir uprising, but not also a bread riot? Because prices of bread had gone up and so on. You know, these, what are these? They don't always become peaceful. You know, look at Egypt. One minute it's the, you know, you think, oh my God, it's a liberal uprising. No, come on, guys. People come with all kinds. I remember in Tahrir, you know, seeing not only the Muslim Brotherhood, not only, you know, anarchists, students, all of them, socialists. I also saw the young kids who came out of the cemetery where they sleep at night. These are the young kids who have nothing to lose. And they were just pelting the police with stones. There was a guy, famous guy called a sniper. He was, I think, a military police guy. He sat up on a building and shot these kids in the eye. One kid after the other. His incredible aim. He was later prosecuted. He was going after these kids. He wasn't shooting at the college students or the Muslim Brotherhood alone. Mainly these kids, you know. These kids all they knew was pick up the rocks and throw it at the cops, because they grew up structured into violence. They live in that giant cemetery, for God's sake, in Cairo. You know, I mean, that's their life. I saw so many of these kids like running in packs, you know, fighting the cops and so on. That's what they know. You can't turn around and say, well, the children should behave themselves. I'm sorry. You structure the world violently, and that's what you're going to get. Now the question for us is, how do we build responsible organizations, political education, and so on, to advance history beyond that immediate impulse of violence? You know, I'm not interested in a history of violence. I want to create a history of political struggle where we actually advance the cause of humanity, but I'm not prepared to turn around and blame those little kids and not the police and the military and so on. You know, the United States bombing and destroying Libya, or bombing and destroying Iraq, you know, they get off the hook, and then we're going to blame some little kids who throw rocks. Come on, guys. That's such a terrible attitude towards history and human advancement.
Well, hoping that humanity does advance. Thank you so much, Vijay, for taking the time with us today. It's really an honor, and I'm sure that everyone listening also feels similarly.
It's great to be with you, and we'll meet again soon.
Thank you so much again, Vijay.
can't comprehend. Every time give out some love, and you find peace of love. And my darling, one more thing. If you let me, I will take you to live where love is king. Oh, baby.
And that was special guest Vijay Prashad on Labor Radio here, 90.3 FM in Montreal. So big thanks to Vijay for spending that time with us and off the air offering us a bit of parenting advice, of course. We'll be back next month with another show. You can catch us on the Labor Radio Podcast Network as well. Just look them up on Facebook or online anywhere. You can find the website and lots of other labor-related podcasts and radio shows. My name is Stefan.
And this is Mustafa. And thanks, everybody, for listening to Labor Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
If it appears that COVID-19 symptoms like cough, fever, sore throat, and loss of taste and smell are beginning to present themselves, you can begin to self-isolate and take a rapid test at home. After getting your test results, you can learn more about proper self-isolation guidelines by visiting quebec.ca/self-isolating. This information is there to help protect you and everyone living under the same roof. All of us can make a difference, so let's keep making sure all of us are safe. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, also known as Chuchage and Munuyang, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, February 17th, 2022. On tonight's show, my guests, actress and writer Julie Vincent, author of The Doorman of Windsor Station, now adapted into a radio play. The story is inspired by a mysterious man she met at a cafe.
We saw each other. We started a kind of relationship, and I started the kind of very human investigation with him. And 6 months later, I was pursuing his past in the city of Montevideo. That was how it started.
Dancer and choreographer Andrew Turner on 18 Practices, his exploration of Homer's Odyssey.
Dancing sort of opened up a whole layer of richness of experience that I didn't know existed when I was walking around in my head all the time. So it's great to sort of be in my body.
And French electronic music producer Molecule.